station number 21584, wheel 3.
Ted Weeks, reel 3. How did you like being in a minesweeper like the Eastbourne?
I enjoyed the work, it was tough. And theoretically, you only could only work in fair weather. It was hard work, dirty work.
Why was it so dirty?
Well, you were handling greens and wires, and you towed a kite, what they call a kite, an otter, about half a mile astern. And you had to heave them in and hoist them out. And also, too, you had to lay mines, buoys. Now, are we on the tape?
Yes.
Well, one of the awkwardest things about being a minesweeper was this, that when we were driven out of Europe, we left in Brussels or in Belgium, there were 500,000 British mines left behind. So, we were sweeping up our own mines. Life didn't get complicated as a minesweeper until Jerry ran out of our mines and using his own, which I thought was unfair. We didn't know what they were composed of. So, the word went out, you know, that the first, be very careful, but we'd like some information about German mine. We picked up the first one. This is what I got the medal for.
The DSM.
Well, we were off Harwich. And I can't paint the scene, minesweeping. In the North Sea, you're always rolling and rolling. Don't matter if it's a nice sunny day, you're still rough seas. And they're flat bottomed because, obviously, for their work, they're built like a tug and they've got the power, strength. They haven't got the speed. But they've got the power, the strength. Well, now, the skipper's on the bridge, and we're sweeping. And it was finished the day's work, and we were packing up to go home, back to harbour. So each ship makes its own way back, hauling their gear back, cleaning up. Well, we were left, we got tangled up with something, and what do you do? It's a mine, it's a floating... positive buoyancy. And it's got glass knobs sticking up, covered with a very light aluminium metal. If you knock the knobs off, it's got acid inside there, which operates the ignition for the mine, runs the mine. So therefore, our procedure was this always, to get hold of the mine, and not as eye bolts all round. If you had one of an English mine, You either, we had armour-piercing bullets. You fired at it to sink it. Or if you hit one of the doors, it blew up. Oh, very good. We ran a sweepstake on the ships. Pun it on the mast. One, you know, mine's gone up. Sometimes the bullet would pierce the mine's calcification and it would sink by seawater getting in and losing its buoyancy. Well, now, on this particular day, I'll give you the background. On this particular day, there was this mine, and it wasn't one of ours. So the only way you pick it up is you get a long stave with a spring hook on the end, and with a wire that runs down, and you hold in your hand, and the wire goes through a crane onto a winch. So, like a long stave with a hook on the end, and as soon as you... it's got a fitting one end where the pole sticks through, and you can pull the pole out, and it's free then. And because it's a spring hook, you can let go of everything, and the wire still is on the capstan. With me?
Yes.
Well, it was so bad weather, and little tiny chaps and the crew. So I, on this particular occasion, I got hold of the long hook on the stave, reached out, and it was so extended, and there was a mine bolt up and down, and I was trying to hook one of the rings. And I hit the mine, and it went round the mine. And I, by this time, I was almost exhausted, the arm at full stretch, you know. But it went round, and it hooked up under the chain underneath. So I said to the winch, right, see what happens, heave in. So when we heaved in, we had the Chevron upside down. So a signal was made to, well, what do we do with it then? And the little David that it was hanging from was a flimsy looking affair. And as the ship was throbbing, the engines, you know, the propeller going round, there was a bouncing on this doing, what could we do with it? Where do we do it? We couldn't lower them. Anyway, eventually we got some pile of pudding fenders, rope fenders, and gently lowered it down on there. And the skipper shouted to me, I'll leave it to you. Well, he wasn't an active service, and I was only an active service bloke on the ship. So, anyway, they made a signal saying that we've got this mine, and we had a blast then from Admiralty for putting the ship at risk with the crew, blowing the ship up, and we shouldn't have done it. We should have waited, and so they sent out, so we were told to remain at sea until we send some experts out from Portsmouth or whatever. So we're getting ticked off, picking this mine up at first, and then they go somewhere. Skipper got the DSO, and I got a DSM. The experts come out, and they had the knowledge of what the German mine was made of.
Where did all this take place?
Off Harwich.
About, do you remember which year that was?
I could tell you because I've got the official Admiralty orders, date, and so on.
Were you in the Eastbourne very long?
All the war. That's from 1942 to 1946.
And were you always in the North Sea in the Channel?
Pardon?
Were you always in the North Sea?
Oh, no. We were around... mostly down the south coast here, convoys and Isle of Wight ferry, on the south coast mostly, and the attacking, you know, for we were based in Portland. That Portland was our home base really, and that's where all the every time they were planning an attack, minesweeper would go out. And they'd have an expert on a fast, a very fast boat, and pick up back of the sand somewhere. Bring it back of the sand.
Why?
Well, to test it, see what vehicle could, if it was suitable for a tank to land, or a car or vehicle. This is a mistake they made that, Oh, man, I'm on the memorial, I ought to mention that. The bombing, Calais and Dunkirk. When they lost all the Canadians?
Dieppe.
Every time there was a raid, it had to be minesweepers first. So we were on every raid, practically. You're Dieppe.
Were you on the Dieppe raid?
Yes.
What do you remember of that?
My name's on a memorial in Dieppe.
What do you remember of the Dieppe raid?
Usual mine-sweeping raid, dark at night, and the transports coming over, and once we'd done our job, we were finished with it.
What about D-Day? Were you in...
Oh, Dieppe? Yes.
What time to you at D-Day?
First of all, we left Portland the day before it was planned. The day it was planned, June 6th or 5th, I forget which was. And we went out and did a night sweep. All the minesweepers. Now, they were doing channels right through to France. And the scientists had developed a mine or a buoy that would sink during the day and pop up at night with a light on. So the Germans couldn't see by day the obvious work that was being done, but when it got midnight somewhere, up would come the Germans, and there's all these channels, and these were the ships that were coming in, destroyers and so on, transports, and to see their way through clear minefields. But we went out the day before, and the weather turned nasty, and it was cancelled for 24 hours. Meanwhile, Jimmy the One, the first lieutenant, and I had drunk a bottle of brandy, because we'd done our job, we'd got to France, and we were out of radio silence, naturally. Radio silence. They sent a boat out to tell us personally, man to man, could go back to Portland and top up with fuel, come back for tomorrow. So we'd done the job, finished the job, we had to come back again, fuel up, and finish the job. And we were the link between the American forces and the British forces. We were the link, minesweeper, in between. And when actually landing, we got there about 6 o'clock in the morning, and the ships were all behind us, and it was planned for office hours, landing, 8 o'clock onwards. So we had 2 hours to wait. And the idea was they weren't sure whether the big guns at Cherbourg would have been put out of action by the RAF or not. But we were, if they hadn't, we'd have had it. So we were spent their time fishing.
Fishing?
Fishing. Well, what else to do? We were off the beachhead. We were there at anchor, more or less. They went fishing. And going back a bit. Am I still on the tapes?
Yes.
Every time a marshal goes to sea on a dirty job, you know, on a risky job, you carry the doctor. They'd run out of doctors in our case, and we had a vet, an Irish vet. And he was as mad as all the Irish vets. And the first thing he did was operate on the cat. The first thing he did was come. And he put, I had an office that I was able to let him use for his equipment. Because it's small, it's only 650 tons, minesweeper. And he had his cat's testicle in the bottle. So when we were fishing, they were saying, what can we use for bait? So they all went down and got bread and pieces of bacon or whatever. So I remembered the cat. And herring after herring came up. I was the only one catching fish. It's true. Whether you want to use that or not, it's something new about that. That's the truth. I was eating fish and they were all looking at me, what have you got for us? And the vet kept looking at me, so I recognised that somewhere. And the sailor said to the, in those days, these pit boys, they don't care what they're, no discipline at all, turned around the vet, said, what do you do that to the cat for? He said, well, let's stop if it'd go in harbour somewhere, the cat'll leave a ship. But if I do that, it won't leave a ship. He said, oh, we'll be doing us next then. That's the story.
Did your ship get fired on D-Day?
Not really. No, we never got to. We cruised up and down pulling vessels off the beach that got stuck. You know, that sort of thing. Now, I'll come to heavy stuff in a minute, though, what we did.
Can you tell me, please?
Pardon?
Can you tell me now?
Yes. I'm when you finish, right? I'm going to do. You know, later on, and towards the end of the war, or do you want to go on with the what?
Carry on, yes.
Well, we were sent these orders to see if Cherbourg was out of action. And, as I say, a sort of amazing sights, one of the most impressive, they'd requisitioned all the London barges the Admiralty had, and they converted all the upper deck, took all the gear off, and put racks of rockets, controllable from sea, ages. And every time, the theory was, every time that the troops so far ahead, they could angle them overhead, beyond them, another 150 yards, 200 yards, and to see these rockets firing off, nobody there, off the beach. Amazing. That's one of the few things that never gets, seems to get mentioned. The rockets on these barges, controlled by something at sea, and then they put perfectly where we were. They were loaded. Actually, the Americans were tousing, but the efficiency from our side of it was just right. Anyway, later on, towards the end of the war, I think we were the first ship in Europe, in occupied Europe, went to Ostend. The danger, again, of course, a minesweeper only costs a couple of bob. So if you lose a minesweeper, the loss, not very bad. Made of cocoa tins anyway. And but the if they send a warship in, the expense of loss begins to Ostend. First thing we found was all the mains, water for the dockyard, you know, for the landing pot at Ostend. In the harbour, we're all swapped over. Oil, gas, water, they're all swapped over. So you couldn't use them. And by this time, German prisoners of the war were coming down to be shipped back to England. And the first lieutenant said to me, "What do you fancy, a walk across the sea? So you come with me?" I said, "Well, what do you want me to go with you?" He said, "Well, I understand it's a minefield." Anyway, we watched the Germans watching over there with their crowned and anchor boards and their draft boards and their little possessions coming back to England for. But whilst we were there, there was a fast patrol boats. What do they call them now?
MTBs?
MTBs, yeah. Came in, and there was about six of them in Ostend. And one day, what had happened, some of the Germans had downed tools, and because Belgians had been half German anyway, and worked as dockyard workers in the dockyard. And these MTBs had been cleaning up, pumping out the bilges, fuel. And somebody slung a lighted ball of cotton waste. Six MTBs went up, flames. On the jetty alongside where we were lying, there were things like pistols on the sloping side of the jetty, the stone jetties. And there was things like valuables, as though somebody had thrown them out there. But they were all wired up with explosives. The next job was Pluto, pipeline out of the ocean, when they had a ship. You said that? You know about this? Well, we escorted it.
The Eastbourne?
The Eastbourne escorted it, yes. There's a reason for this, all these jobs we used to get. It's all made of different engines, all these minesweepers. Experimental, you know. Some were diesel electric. Some were all fuel. We were, what's the word? Car engine, you might say. Not car engine, but all fuel, but what's the word? Anyway.
Carry on, anyway.
Hmm?
Carry on.
Yes. We were sent up to London to be converted into a tug. Now, this thing was, the Germans, when they realised they were on a losing wicket 2 years before the end of the war, they mined all their coast. And what they used a mine that was on the seabed, couldn't be swept up. The only thing about it was it got covered up with silt or sand, whatever. So when we were in a position to tell, you know, to do what we like around the coast of Europe, where the biggest problem was that is operated by a vacuum. If you went over this mine, a pressure, a ship going through the sea at more than 12 knots would set off the explosive. It's a long time before they realised that, but they couldn't find out how to mine these up. The Americans tried a huge vacuum cleaner, suck the sand off, and have a look, see what. What we did, what I'm coming to now, we were converted into a tug. And it was a 10,000 crate, it was called a crate. Imagine the top of that tray, the 10,000 ton. And there was pockets, water, air, water. So it was just floating, most of it below water. And it was just about 18 inches above water, but it weighed 10,000 ton. And our deal was to tow it through water and settle the mine by pressure. So we went to Nijmegen in Holland, Schelk Lestri. And we towed this thing. And you know, 10,000 tons this was. And during the night, about 11 o'clock, it was my job. I mean, I had responsibility. On occasions, I used to get up and have a walk around, see if everything was okay. And this particular night, it was a dirty night. And I looked out, and the towing wire was ahead of the ship. And the currents were stronger than we were at the surface. And this 10,000 tons was ahead of us, and we were heading for it. And, you know, that sort of thing was happening. Marvellous. It didn't. The only unusual thing about it was that the pockets that were free, in other words, the seawater was inside, you know, there was pockets of four abreast. Air, water, air, water. In the water parts, seagulls had got in, and they couldn't get out because they couldn't fly off. They needed a takeoff, seagulls, and needed about 10-foot takeoff. And they were there, and they were so we were towing a load of seagulls, funny seagulls. Can you imagine it?
Where was this?
This was going up to Nijmegen for. Doing this after the war, you know, just well, the war was still on actually. So we were minesweeping then.
Which was the happiest ship you were in?
Pardon?
Which was the happiest ship that you were in?
Oh, the Dragon, completely. America, happiest ship.
What
was the
Dragon?
You couldn't be happy on a minesweep because they were for a different breed of people. They weren't people who were living on water. They were mines people, you know. They had no time for sailors.
What was the Dragon? Was it HMS Dragon?
Yes.
What kind of ship was that?
A light cruiser.
In the 30s?
But
in the 1930s?
1930, yep. It was a World War ship, First World War ship. Dragon D-class, they were a D-class light cruiser.
Why were you so happy in the ship?
Well, they're nearly all athletes. You know, they were all sort of people who were fit. And there was a reason for this. Previous ships gone to we belonged to South American West Indies Squadron. Six ships. And in the past, they've had a terrific bashing from the Americans, sports-wise. And along came these people who were building up this cruiser coming to America, headed by Wake Walker and all these rich people, and Fitzroy, House Speaker, and House, a lot of enthusiasm. So they were assembled without, you know, done it surreptitiously, and nearly all the crew were in some kind of sport. And my pal was heavyweight boxing champion. I didn't mind. I played cricket and I ran and swam, played water polo. So eventually, when we went to America, we were loaded out for revenge. And the only people that beat us all the time for 3 years I was out in America was a woman's baseball team. We gave in, you know. We surrendered. But the San Diego, they because of their association with previous British ship being in there, walkover, they put a very minor warship as a host ship to us, which in turn sort of we competed. Oh, we made them. We made busted out of those, and we swept them up with and everything.
Did you ever come across homosexuality in the Navy?
Very, very rarely. Very rarely, yes. When I was in the Mediterranean on this Sandhurst, I was aware of one chap. Marvellous chap, no respects. We were a storeship. And as I told you before, all destroyers and that. And when we used to store our ship, there was flour, 140 pound flags of flour. And the chap who was a storeman was a huge chap. He threw these bags of 140 pound flour around like, you know. But he was.
He was what?
He was homosexual. And the only other occasion was in Chatham, when my pal used to box locally for £20 or that. But in the boxer fraternity, there was a youngster who was very, very good. And one night he was apprehended in Chatham wearing women's clothes. Now, it's the only other time that I was aware of it. I mean, when you're a sport, you've only got one ambition, to get ashore and have a go at something, you know, sort of swimming or whatever.
Did homosexuality in the Navy cause any disruption to the crews?
No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
How were they treated?
No, it was very rare, so there was no question of, there was no sort of a treatment at all about you. You accepted the chap as he was. He was a good messman or a good pal or, I mean, you can't understand the passionate almost feeling about sailors collectively. All of them. Now what ship was I on then? I was on one of these destroyers. What was I? In the Mediterranean. And the chap who was a likeable rogue. And for punishment, his leave was stopped for 3 months. But the doctor says he must have run ashore for medical reasons. Well, he was the toughest person I've ever met, this chap was. Nicest chap. But so they all collected for him to pay his, you know, his visit ashore. When he got ashore, two rogues set on him, two Spanish. One of them was killed, broke his neck. They couldn't have picked on a tougher type, these two. They were hopeless. The other one ran away, but the other one, he must have picked him up and threw him against the tree, broke his neck.
Where did this happen?
Where? South of Spain. Spain. Near Malaga? Near Malaga. Not very far from Gibraltar, anyway. And the next morning, of course, the signal from the police came ashore that one of their sailors, it was said that a sailor had killed a local Spaniard. And so, after they'd investigated, the captain cleared load, they had the low deck cleared. And he said, I want everybody who went ashore on this particular night to pay one pace forward. And everybody took a pace forward. So what we did, we pulled up back and went to sea. Forgotten.